There is a project called Disnix, which is used to distribute one configuration of our network. So you can define with a configuration file how the server interacts. But Sanders shall come soon to describe this project.
Well, then you have machine deployment, which normally probably is the same, goes in the same area as config management. We get machines which are donated normally, so they sit in some data center we don't know of, and then somebody puts a Sanders version on there, and then we do the stuff we do. I think it might be different with other people, other distributions.
I know.
I'm not sure about that. I think Debian probably gets all the stuff donated to them.
We get all the stuff donated, yeah. Some of it is for the build system especially. Some of them are privately owned, although we're phasing those out. But most of our stuff gets donated in many cases by HP, because HP is a very big sponsor of Debian. And presumably they get installed by a Debian person and they do that stuff. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, with the Gentoo ones, I'd say less than 15% of the machines are actually owned by us. Mainly it's a machine sitting in a data center somewhere, and we ask them, please boot it on a live CD and tell us the IP and we'll install it.
Right.
Actually, Nokia runs all the hardware from MAMO, which is kind of uncool, but that's kind of an interesting side problem to what you guys are. How many machines does CentOS have then for its infrastructure? Do you know?
Without counting all the dead ones, I guess around 150?
150.
Is that correct?
How about Gentoo?
What do you do with such large number? What do you do with such large number of machines?
Mirrors, for a large part.
Ah, so you count mirrors too?
It's a machine.
They are owned by you, all the mirrors.
No.
Okay. Rephrase the question there. How many machines does your infrastructure team directly manage and have control
and
over?
150, that's what I said.
So you have root on those 150 machines.
You manage 50 machines?
To
Maro.
What?
We can
access those. Those are
our
machines.
Okay.
They get pulled from some time to time, but new ones come up. So, if you want to have test, if you need test machine, because you say, well, I want to test out something new, you can get a machine from that pool to do that.
Right.
If you want to do test setups, you can get. But normally, many of those are, well, mirrors to feed other mirrors from.
Right. Okay.
So that's primarily kind
so
of.
So most of the times they are doing mirror stuff, but on demand they can be used for something else.
Yes.
Right. How many does Gentoo have?
In Gentoo, we have about 60 main infrastructure machines at the moment. And then another 20 odd build machines.
So that's, yeah, well,
I'm not in the infrastructure team, as I said, but on a blog of a guy who actually is in the infrastructure team, for Debian, they were talking about 100. I don't know where that figure comes from, but 100 is what I heard.
How many do you guys have?
Oh, I think it's much smaller than that. For build system, it's about 10 machines, 10 systems, just to build.
Up until November, MAMO had one.
Yeah.
And then they pushed everything out to Akamai.
Oh.
Yeah. Yep. Nokia pays that bill.
To build?
No. They had another machine that they built internally, but because of NDA restrictions, that's behind a firewall. It's a really broken system. I don't recommend it.
But.
And then you do have the management side of infrastructure. So. Where do those machines come from? Who do I have to say thank you for? Which machines do I have to look after I read, well, listen, this company went boom.
Debian actually had set up an LDAP directory over a decade ago where all that kind of stuff is managed. It's all stored.
Public interest?
Yeah, we have a file or several files.
Well, you really want to have something that's more
internal wiki with version control.
Right. Yeah.
Okay,
well,
what
we have is an LDAP directory where not only all users are stored, but also all machines, with some extra schema stuff added to it, so you can actually add stuff like who's the local administrator, who's the donator, what's the SSH key stored in there as well.
Who do you phone when the machine goes down?
Yeah, exactly. That kind of stuff is stored.
Does anybody use something like, what's what I call? GDI? No, not GDI. GLPI? GLPI or something different from that?
I don't know what you're
being
talking
about. Being database for doing exactly that.
No.
Mm.
Right, this thing, this LDAP was set up before I became a developer, and I'm became a Debian developer in 2001, so it's quite old. It's working not too bad. It has its issues. It's something homegrown, as is the case for much in Debian. So yeah, it does the job.
Okay, and then you have the planning side, updates, new machines, how do you do testing, how do you deploy stuff out there? Does the mirror network now go to CentOS 5 completely from CentOS 4, or how do you plan those updates?
Well, the Debian mirror network is not owned by Debian, actually. It's mostly people who run a general mirror, and we can add Debian to
okay,
it
sure,
as well.
Sure, we have those. Those are most of our mirrors, too,
right,
sure.
Right.
But you have the internal stuff, because, well, Debian and probably has the same luxury as we have. We have pretty long running distributions.
Well,
so it's like, well, we have 7 years. So
well,
if
yes.
Some of the machines are still CentOS 4, they will run.
Ours are release of the next distribution plus 1 year, actually. So that's currently about 3 years. So not as long.
Do you think there's a possibility to share some of the infrastructure across distro, particularly mirrors? I mean, since they're basically two major packaging formats, you would think that a lot of RPMs are duplicated across the various mirrors, across the various distros.
Well,
but
not necessarily the same RPMs.
No, not necessarily the same
version.
They may
depend on different versions of libraries.
Yeah, that's true, but there's probably some redundancy. I mean, do you think you could have multiple mirrors, multiple package repos?
Yeah, but before trying to share binary packages, it would mean starting to share either spec file for RPM, sharing macros.
It's only a working way. I mean, if you look at Debian and Ubuntu, they sometimes have packages with the same name because they were built from the exact same source. But the version in Debian was built against this library, and the version in Ubuntu was built against that library. So if you try installing the Ubuntu version on a Debian machine, everything goes kaboom. So don't try that.
Well, you could have separate repos.
Well, but then you're not really sharing structure anymore. You're just sharing a hard disk, that's all.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to just sharing hard disk, I think you may end up getting better results out of file systems with deduplication. Because they don't have to know that the file's the same thing.
Right.
Well, Canonical, or at least Mark Shuttleworth, proposed that and said, well, let's, at least for the enterprise distributions, let's all have the same kernel. Let's all have the same glibc, which doesn't work either, I guess. But
something is happening there between
that
the
would be that would be one possibility to move in a direction like that. But on the other hand, it's just, well, you have machines, we have machines, we can lend machines. But I don't think that you can really share mirrors, because it's just too dependent on what distribution is on there. I mean, Mandriva is using RPM, so I won't get any Mandriva RPM installed on CentOS normally without force. With force, it doesn't work then.
Well, it does, but you get to get keyboard pieces.
Yeah.
Well, actually, 6 pieces.
Okay, that's not really infrastructure, but that also has to happen. How do you people document your internal stuff?
Documented. Yes.
Wiki.
Well, we also
lock it down. Internal access only. Wiki.
No, it's public.
Public
everything
wiki
public.
And
nothing
policy
secret.
Documents.
Well,
we have private
we have
phone numbers in there even.
No, we don't have that in
Wiki. So where do you share that information?
Well, it's on an internal mailing list
that
people
that's
write
not
it
documentation.
Down. Everything we do in wikis is just
we should
the
organize
public
that
stuff.
Better. Phone numbers and stuff. We should organize that better.
Yeah, but you can't call me anyway.
That's why an elder battery is a good idea. That's why an elder battery is a good idea. You just do LDAP search and you have the information. And you can lock that down with passwords if you only want your own developers to have that information. In Debian, we actually have a web front end as well where you can search and update stuff. So that works really well, in my opinion. For documentation, we actually have three modes. Mainly, we've got people uploading packages with documentation, such as for our policy and stuff like that. We've also got the wiki, where presumably a lot is documented, and we have the in the web page, which is mainly a public. CVS repository that gets automatically converted to web and stuff. So basically, I think everybody does it that way.
Wiki seems to be
Just wanted to mention that within Fedora, for example, there's something like a Tasks, which is an accounting system where people can subscribe and manage their own personal information. This lets the user decide which information he or she wants to share with others. You can simply say, I want to share my email address, I want to share my phone number, if so, between the development cycle. And these information could then easily be queried from IFC. We have a passport in IFC, you can simply put a man on that and query that information there. And this is a very useful process for direct communication. What I want to say is, which information do you really want to hide?
Actually, I've started.
Let the user decide which information he or she would want to hide. And do not generally set up a hidden process, because that's always something strange. I prefer open process, where the users or the developers or the members of the community can either decide if they want to share or not to share their information. Besides, for example, we have an LDAP server and all that stuff too, 389, something like that.
Okay, there has to be infrastructure stuff which is not public, because I'm not going to tell anybody the IP addresses of the servers, mostly. Oh, well, okay, that's
fine.
Just
look up.
Why not? But don't want to have a list on there who's admin on the machine or who is responsible for a machine or.
Why not?
Why
is it information secret?
Why would that be?
At least between the infrastructure.
Yeah, you're saying we share on the infrastructure team on his private wiki.
Sure.
All the infrastructure team has access to
Why shouldn't it be public, though?
You have to have passwords.
Somewhere.
Okay, obviously the passwords are not going to be on a public wiki. That
right.
makes sense. But
the donators don't have to be on there.
Why not? I mean, if
they
somebody,
want to, yes. If they don't want to,
so,
no.
So,
yeah.
some of our sponsors explicitly requested.
Yeah, that's a different matter. That's a different matter. But saying, I thought you meant in general they shouldn't be there. That would be
yeah, okay.
silly. Some people would explicitly request that they are listed there. But what I'm thinking is much of this information, as long as it wouldn't compromise your security, that I don't think there's any harm in making it public. And it actually makes it easy for people, if they see something is going wrong, makes it easy to figure out where to go.
Yeah,
sorry.
Absolutely.
As also the process how to take part in the because I wouldn't know how to become an infrastructure member at least for Gentoo or something. Maybe there's some
Posts
on the wiki or something which is public.
There is a page on the main website.
And you're quite far beyond some other distribution. If this process is clearly defined, then you can simply take part in this infrastructure team and you have your responsibilities, and within this infrastructure team you share the information like in any other team, it's totally
Fedora has standard operating procedures that they publicly list, so anybody who saw a server go down reads the standard operating procedures and follows those procedures to bring the server back up, right?
And I'm not sure why not share this information.
Yeah, a lot of other distros don't do that.
Yeah,
but then
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
It is indeed a major problem within Debian. To get more volunteers to work on that is true.
Yeah, finding infrastructure people is very difficult.
Yes.
But standard operating procedures, I think, would really help.
Yes. There are a bunch of our procedures on the internal wiki that we really should publish, like how we go about installing a new machine from scratch.
Right.
That'd be good to know.
You do that yourself?
No. Like based on your initial shell, this is what you have to do to fire up the automation.
Okay.
So I have to largely agree with what these guys said. It's it's some sort of in the spirit of open source that you just it won't compromise your security. So you just put it online in a public wiki, just protect the page from being edited by anyone, and then you write there, well, we do it this way. Any user can read how you do it, but he won't be able to just do it because he doesn't have the right credentials to access anything, and it wouldn't be really transparent for someone who stands for open source software, when it just says, well, our internal structure is hidden from you. You don't see how we work internally. So it's a natural thing for me. And the information that has actually to be kept secret is just a few access credentials and phone numbers, and the rest can be made public because there's no secrets among those.
There's an extension question about there. Discussion we've been having at the moment. Should all users be able to see Nagara's status of what's down?
Why not?
Yes.
What's the harm? What's the harm? I mean, exactly, because I mean, if you go to, I think it's actually there's a benefit to it, because if you try to access something and it doesn't respond, then it might be at your end, it might be, mm-hmm. be at the remote end. If you can actually access the monitoring system, where you can see, oh yes, this server is down, then you know you don't need to look further. You just need to tell the right people that, hey, this server is down, you might want to reboot it. Whereas if you don't know that the server is down, you might be assuming that, oh, it's probably going to be running because these guys are good. So it has to be on my end, and you're wasting half an hour or half a day to figure out that actually the server was down. So it's actually a good thing to make those kinds of things public. And I don't think it would compromise your reputation or anything, because if your server goes down occasionally, because I mean everybody has a server go down occasionally, it's not a big thing.
But the only project we can find that's doing this already is Mozilla.
Debian Semi does that. Not really. There's something. Some website where you can actually go.
Yeah,
but
the Mozilla one is not exactly well published.
Well,
you have to know what the URL is.
Yeah, same goes for ours, and it comes up with a password, which is guest or something.
Yes.
So I mean, it's semi-public, but I don't think it there's any harm in having it public, as long as you don't put passwords.
Well, depends
on
the
yes.
Yeah.
The Wikipedia Foundation, the Wikia guys publish both the Nagios and the cactigraphing publicly.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I think a part of the Yahoo open source group do as well. But these are both, of course, commercial companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think most distributions publish their Miro stuff. The status, most distributions publish the status of the Miros.
Yes.
Yeah. Which certainly makes sense, because, yeah.
And also because those are machines you can't control always yourself. So.
Right.
But I think the hard part is to find what I mentioned before, to find new members for the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something I already discussed a lot of times as well. How do you want to decide, how do you want to make sure that one who got the knowledge to manage the machines, who is a trusted person, and who knows what he or she does, will get into the infrastructure team. And this is something I'm not yet sure how to filter. I haven't found a way how to filter that these aspects. Because what? How do you want to filter that? Does one of the old infrastructure members, for example, have to know the new infrastructure member personally? What if he or she comes from India and nobody knows him or her? How can you make sure that you can trust him or her? How do you handle these things? How do you bring new people?
I think the trust thing is the largest thing, because seeing what people can do, they can vocalize themselves on mailing lists and say, well, what you're doing there is playing wrong, because if you want to do it correctly, do it that and that and that way. So you get from people, well, they know the stuff they're doing and they're interested in doing stuff. But I think the trust thing really is goes very, very deep.
In Debian, that trust problem is basically solved by saying that only Debian developers can become infrastructure people.
Yeah.
And then
you have the developer process, which is rather harsh.
I would not use.
Has anybody?
Do you note that I'm involved with that developer process?
Yeah.
I wouldn't use that word harsh, but I understand.
Oh,
yeah, it's involved. That's
it's getting better.
It's getting better. It's getting much better.
I didn't say it was bad. So
you said harsh.
You said harsh.
It's the same thing.
I know what you mean.
A related question there: is anybody that's joined Debian explicitly to work on the infrastructure team, or did they join as a developer first?
Probably.
As a developer on purpose?
Don't think so. I'm not entirely sure about that. I don't think so. We did get one person who joined just to do documentation, not packaging. And in theory, there's no problem with joining just as an infrastructure member. We don't have a procedure for that yet. If somebody were to suggest that they wanted to do that, we would have to figure out how to come up with that. But basically, if you are a Debian developer, or if you want to be part of the infrastructure team, you have to be a Debian developer. That's basically our process currently.
So by definition, then, you have to become a Debian developer before you can be considered to contribute that way. You know, become a Debian developer, you either have to do packaging work or documentation.
And people have to know you, don't they?
You can get the code for Debian build systems and for DAC and for RepRepro and all that stuff and commit patches, and that's
right.
One way to get in. And
yeah.
I'm sure if you did that, you'd get sponsored and
right.
it'd be a very easy way in. So
yeah.
in that regard, it's all open. They're not necessarily going to let you log on to the machines and start hacking code, but the code's all available.
Yeah.
Okay, but does that mean some of the old infrastructure team needs to know the new infrastructure personally?
Not personally, but you need to know who he is, and you need
right.
I mean, not personally as in person, but you need to know who they are. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like in the case of the Gen 2 stuff, there's two cases. First of all, are you explicitly joining as infrastructure? And we've only had I think three people from that, and they all happened to work at OSL's Open Source Lab.
Uh-huh.
So they already knew what our infrastructure that was there, and that's why
infrastructure don't that.
Yeah, they've got a bunch of machines already. That's why they were joining. But then you have to have been a developer for at least 3 months, and somebody else that is already an infrastructure member must vouch for you.
So that's
being
your
a developer process. Means you have to have some e-builds and packages
well,
in the system.
No, in our case, it's even more general than that. Moderators on the forums. We don't have the Gen 2 wiki is not in-house, it's actually entirely an external entity that runs it, so it doesn't really count.
Right.
But there have been some knowledgeable people there that we've said, hey, you know what you're doing.
Go ahead, right.
And like that, so they're sort of documentation, but not really.
Right.
So the next logic step would be kind of mentoring process. To let the new maintainer know how to treat the processes, because they might be not very well documented, some kind of special. Is there something like a mentorship?
Isn't that the only way to do it? Because all the build systems are different. You know, knowing
yeah.
how to build packages on Debian is not going to help you know how to build packages for CentOS, and the infrastructure is catering to those tools, and the infrastructure is probably custom made. So isn't probably the only way to, say, recruit people and mentor them through?
That's one of the reasons why I wanted to have this round table here, to learn how others do it. And if there maybe there are processes where we can say, well, let's do that together, or well, let me learn from you, because you seem to be doing it the right way.
Well, there isn't any right or wrong way. Every distribution has its own rules.
But I think
sure.
that these process like mentorship is not wrong in any kind of distribution.
I'm listening to all of you, and it's really, really interesting for me, because I'm a user. But I noticed that there isn't any explanation of the role of every person on the infrastructure. Debian says that you have to be Debian developer, so this is the top, I understand?
Sure. The top as in? Debian developer is just a person who has the ability to upload packages into Debian, so can actually
and can vote.
And can vote.
Also
yeah.
Also, too generic. There isn't any specific role of a member, not only in Debian, on every distribution. And I think this is something wrong. I think that every person on distribution on infrastructure has to have a specific role and not to do all things.
Oh, so, okay.
Packaging.
Well, we do have that. We do have that. It's not be mentioned yet, but it doesn't mean we don't have it. At least in Debian, we've got people who do mailing lists, and we've got people who do system
yeah.
administration, we've got people who do FTP master, which is the mirror network.
People in charge of the build.
Yeah,
and
so
then we have a technical team who governs all of Debian too.
Oh.
So there's a lot of very well-defined roles.
That's certainly true. Yeah. it would be crazy not to do it, because otherwise some people would have to do everything and
right.
Just doesn't work.
That's a problem. That's
and
a
they're
problem.
Also not actually interested in doing everything.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
they're interested in like one small thing.
Right.
And, like, we've got two guys that are very interested in the mirror, in our mirror side, and
right.
they run it pretty damn well.
HFC last year said that we have to count the bus effect, and they mentioned that if five or six people are killed now, the project is dead, or some guys are going to continue the project. I think this is something very specific on the role of the persons on infrastructure or distribution.
Yeah, that's why the process has to be clearly defined.
Yeah.
Documented.
Mm. I think the only point I want to make over here, which sort of counters the argument that the gentleman there has made, is that in a volunteer-based organization, holding people down to specific roles creates black holes.
Yeah.
You need, unless you've got a significantly large pool of resources, you cannot have people working within silos. Because if you do, you're creating black holes that you don't know how and when they're going to get you. So in Debian, I'm guessing the numbers are not in a single digit. I'm guessing there's more than 9 people doing infrastructure, so it's probably possible to have
yes.
a couple of people.
Much more. If you count build administrators and system administrators and FTP masters and list masters, I'm sure you'll get in at about 30,
so
40 people, something like that.
So
at least.
Only says the infrastructure team, which is only 7 people.
But it
wow.
changes. I mean, you're pointing to a very fundamental fact that these are volunteer organizations. You can't tell somebody, are you going to work from 9 to 5 this week? You can't say, well, can you even dedicate 40 hours a month? You have to sort of take what they can give.
Sure.
Right.
And that's a fundamental problem. I mean,
when there's a downtime or a break, and we've had 2 in Debian, then yeah, these people need to dedicate a lot of time that they may or may not have.
Mm-hmm.
So it is something you need to worry about, actually.
So by the way, one more thing that I noticed, of course it does not actually apply specifically here, is that developers make very bad sysadmins.
Oh yeah.
Very bad what?
Sysadmins. But we do find that the people who tend to be sysadmins don't tend to have a lot of packages in Debian, in my opinion. They do sysadmin, and they may have 1 or 2 packages, maybe something that they just happen to use. But indeed,
or stuff they use as sysadmin.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. That's something that they happen to use for their sysadmin work in Debian. But usually they don't have a lot of packages. At least what I've looked at. Is this because they spend so much time as sysadmining that they don't have time to do packaging work, or is this some other reason? I don't know, but...
No, yeah. With a bunch of the G2 ones, is that they're not interested heavily in the packaging process.
Right.
Yeah. Developers tend not to care about packaging at all. They see it as a necessary evil that they'd like to get out of. I mean, you look at Python and Ruby, they both have...
What?
Pretty...
Are you calling those packages?
So yeah.
I've long maintained that Ruby has some of the most brilliant people working on it, and GEMS is a very fine example of how a brilliant committee creates a shit product.
Yeah. Definitely.
But these are problems for the distributions, because I hear from developers, Perl developers all the time, they say, oh, Debian's too old. Well, you're using Debian stable. It's not old, it's stable. Use testing. Oh, but that's too cutting edge. No, not unstable, testing. So, I mean, but that's an issue for all distributions.
Use
how,
yeah, sure.
What's your stable period?
You don't
what's
want
your
Apache 2.2? Use Fedora. 2.3, use Fedora.
What that?
Right.
You don't get 7 years with that. Okay, but...
13 months are enough.
What?
13 months are enough.
13 months.
but there's a problem. Developers don't want to do packages because they want to develop.
Right.
Sysadmins don't want to do packages because they want to do sysadmins, but they depend on the packages because
right.
I don't want to sysadmin machines which aren't packaged.
Right.
Thank you.
So somebody has to do packages.
Aren't most developers in all distributions doing mostly packaging work?
most of them in Debian at least, I know.
We have it rather easy. Packaging
yeah.
is done for us.
You guys, you just steal from
yeah.
the chat.
But we are Red Hat Ubuntu, so.
Yeah, something like that. Now, indeed, of course, you've got the infrastructure software. It gets confusing. You've got things like your package manager for Debian SD package, which we develop ourselves. Well, not we, but some of us develop ourselves. And we do have some other software that we need to do, but in DTM, most developers for a distribution will be packages, that's true.
I think Suzy's open build service will present a very interesting challenge, because I think that it can build both Debs and RPMs. And if you have an automated system, you're taking away the human element of building packages, and that's going to...
But you have to have a rules file for the Debian packages, you have to have a spec file for the RPMs, and you have to have a different spec file for SUSE RPMs in there, and for
you have to keep in mind the difference between distributions that are not just only packaging formats, they are more than just a different format for packaging.
Precisely, and when you have an automated tool that builds packages, then you're hopping over a human, and there's a difference in quality in the package.
So does it have the internal knowledge of difference between Debian and Red Hat, for example?
I don't know if OpenSUSE has this, but I do know that there are distributions that use OpenSUSE's build system to build their distro. So.
But what you still need to do is you still have to know, some human has to decide, how do I configure this package? Do I enable this feature? Do I disable it? Do I build two packages that where that's disabled and one it's enabled? Does this package have a plugins infrastructure? Do I ship the plugins in the same package? Do I split them in separate
packages? It's already decided for you in the build system.
That's things that a human has to do. And after that, you don't compile it yourself. After that's decided, you just run your compile tool, and if a bot does it, or if you just type one command to compile, there's no huge difference for me. So the decisions still have to be made by a human who puts these specifications into the build system.
I mean, even if it's not a spec file, it's going to be a configure file,
it's
a main file.
Any specification that
it's
tells
just
you
a specification
what to
of how to build something, and indeed, whether the bots or a human builds it, if I type make or the bot types make, the result is going to be the same, hopefully. So, yeah, well, I do maintain a build system, so I do say hopefully. Anyway.
I mean, for the open source build service, it's of course the case that every package has a maintainer, and more specifically a maintainer group. So we divided up the packages into projects where you can have groups of maintainers. And but it's also true that we build for Debian and RPM-based distributions. And I think that's a chance, because we just agreed that nobody really wants to do packaging work. So developers don't want to, disadvantages don't want to, so we have to seek out specifically for packagers, which aren't, I don't think that's the most attractive thing to do in our world. So
maybe not this
year. You still have to know what the, for example, naming convention is in this.
Yes, of course.
The
packaging is extremely a difficult thing, but it's also true that most people come in as developers or sysadmins, and then they have to be turned or turn themselves into packagers. Right? Or is it?
So you mean enabling users to build packages for?
I mean, enabling people to collaborate on packaging might be help to reduce the pain of packaging.
Would you put those packages officially in your distribution?
Pardon?
Would you take those packages by people you don't know and put them officially in your distribution?
Of course not. No.
But is it okay for you if you create a service where users can put these packages into one centralized searchable repository?
That's OBS.
Like Arrow in the Arch.
I mean, we have some public and searchable repositories, but we always have a review process. So we always have the maintainer group, and these people are responsible to review the.
Yes, of course, not include this, they in the official repository. So
I think we just. Okay, sorry.
About the packaging being the hard work, do you think that part of this is that most packaging formats are hard for users to write, like spec files, e-builds.
Yeah.
I don't say that one of them is harder than another one. It's a matter of preference. But don't you think that it depends on the clarity and simplicity of format to improve the number of users who would like to write it?
Yeah, if you ask me personally, I would say yes. It's a tough and hard job to package. No matter if it's spec or Debian. I would appreciate a more simple thing that covers all, for example. But I know that's completely off in the future because it's hard to do it.
I'm rather fascinated by all these statements because we actually have exactly the reverse problem. So over 90% of people in Arch just, they do packaging. So people package and nobody wants to do the other stuff. So there's people making packages and so on, and then there's nobody taking care of that that mirrors are in shape, and then this task is given to someone and he gets lost in some work and disappears or anything, and nobody wants to do development except the package manager. There's an active development, but all other things that need development, well, they just get stuck and get lost and so on. And packaging is actually the part that has enough people on it, but the rest is just it's just not improving as fast as it should, considering the increasing number of users, increasing number of packages, and so on. So it's just a reverse problem of what most of you said.
Actually, I don't think I said that. What we have in Debian, the main problem is not people not wanting to develop, because that does happen, although there are some cases where we need some more people. But I think the main issue we have in Debian is that because the average for a developer to maintain is about 4 or 5 packages, people start complaining if you do more than 15 or something.
I think I've got my name on a couple hundred.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, if you do more than 15 or 30 packages, people start really complaining in Debian. So, but the main problem we have with that is that people fail to see the big picture, and I think that's one of our main issues for packaging. Because I mean, it's very easy to get focused on those 4 or 5 or 6 packages that you're doing, and not really care about what other packages, how they interact with yours and
so
stuff like that.
So in Debian, packagers in average have a small number of packages.
Small number of packages, yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of team maintainers.
Yeah, I was just about to say that.
Is this encouraged or is just
a
fact?
That's a difficult question. it used to be the case that only that every package only had one maintainer.
Yes.
And every maintainer only had up to 10 packages, and that it's still the case that there is one main maintainer who's listening to maintainer, but more often than not these days, for large things like KDE or GNOME, the maintainer is a mailing list, is a group of people. And then there's people who are listed as uploader or co-maintainers, basically. So we have team-maintained packages. And if you look at team-maintained packages, then you do see that people are often a member of a team where the team maintains like 50-100 packages. What I meant with the 30 packages, if you're listed as the sole maintainer of a package and you have more than 30, then people start. But in teams, the issue is not as big because, I mean, there's more people in the team who can actually look after the package and care for it.
Drifting a little bit into the packaging.
Yeah, sorry. It's an infrastructure thing. Sorry. Yeah.
Sure, it belongs to
yeah,
some parts of the infrastructure, but
it's kind of at the heart of it.
I'm sorry that the HR talk is directly besides this talk here, but I should have been behind each other. We were getting into that also.
Right.
Doing HR for distributions for.
So HR has a new resource?
Yes.
Yep.
Well, we were talking about that all the time at the moment. Because how do people get into a distribution? How do people get into teams and distributions?
Yeah.
That does have to do with infrastructure too, sure. But
yeah.
What I would like to know is, is there any distribution here who pays for their own infrastructure?
Define pace.
If I need 10 servers, I go somewhere, buy 10 servers, and
no,
somewhere.
No. Basically,
15% of our Gentoo machines are owned by the Gentoo Foundation. We do not have a pay for any hosting.
In Debian, the case is mostly that for things like our main servers, if we need them, we just ask Peter Garpy, who is Linux CTO at HP, and he just hands us a bunch of servers. So that's not the issue. In the case of things like architecture-specific hardware, such as build systems, that's harder because HP doesn't have all of them. They have IS64, they have 64-bit and 32-bit x86, but that's about it.
Itanium
is IS64.
Oh, okay.
HPBA, but they don't do that anymore. So there the problem is harder, and in that case, what happens usually is that people privately buy it and then get refunded by the Debian bunch of money. Or when it needs to be repaired, which happens with the older architecture quite often, then those get repaired and get funded by Debian, but we don't actually buy hardware as a
organization. And I guess we are the only one who buys stuff. But it's a little specific because Mandriva is both.
Is a company.
Is a company, and Mandriva Linux is community project.
Right.
So company provides servers.
I would guess that for Fedora, the same would be true actually.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Does Red Hat buy machines for Fedora?
Sorry, what's that?
I think the primary infrastructure in Fedora is actually hosted by and at Red Hat.
Oh, really?
The primary infrastructure team at Fedora is only Red Hat employees.
Yeah,
is that right?
Fedora is Fedora project of Red Hat.
Yeah, but Fedora also has a lot of connected machines. And I know there are at least a dozen hosting companies,
mm-hmm.
and Dell, for example, and HP even, who have donated equipment, which is hosted in infrastructure.
Most of the infrastructure stuff have gone to the cloud and Amazon hosts.
And
they have been moved there. And it's more sponsorship between Amazon and Red Hat and other donations. mix of all.
Do you feel you have an over-concentration of machines at any one single sponsor that it could actually threaten things if that sponsor on its own went away?
Good question.
I don't think we have that. We have two or three core machines and with one sponsor. That could be a problem.
You're a commercial organization. CentOS is, though.
We're not commercial,
no. No.
You're not.
The C is not commercial. The C is community.
But your target is certainly businesses, as opposed to, say, ordinary users.
We want the people who say, well, I need the stability of a enterprise distribution, but don't have the means to pay for that. But I don't get the support, and I know I don't get support for that. So no, not really. If there are businesses who want to use that, yes, sure. Many hosts use it. Not here, not in Europe probably, but in America, lots of hosts are using CentOS. Here you get more Debian or SUSE, I guess. In Europe,
presumably,
at least in Germany.
I think just to counter the, but just in sort of like a reply to your question about a single point of failure. I think the problem that we have within CentOS is something which is completely on the extreme other end, in that we would really like to have more than one machine hosted at the same place. And I think we've only got two sites where you've got more than one machine. So now, if you take the number of machines we've got. And think about the fact that we don't have more than two machines in any one place.
Uh-huh.
You'll see how many different locations
right. We
spread over.
That's
and
painful.
Every person
yeah,
has
painful.
Their own process for support.
Right.
Everybody has
right.
their own ticketing system that you have to go through.
Yeah. We don't have that in Debian, actually. We've got a number of machines hosted at an HP data warehouse, data center, and then some at Brainfood, I guess, though. I'm not sure, that's in Texas. So we've got some 10 locations, and then of course the old small ones.
Houston and Fort Collins for HP.
Sorry?
Houston and Fort Collins.
Two main places for
right, right, yeah.
Houston and Fort Collins.
Right. Yeah, but I was talking about Brainfood, which is Texas. It's a small company. They also have some. They used to host master.org and some other things.
For Gentoo, I'd say 50% of our machines are between four big sponsors that just happen to have the machines there.
Right.
So all problems we can't do failover because. The machines aren't sitting beside each other.
Well,
it could be anything. If those machines don't see each other, that could be anything.
Well,
it doesn't mean that the data center's on fire or...
We can't do failover for other reasons, but yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
that's actually
besides
a larger
that.
Problem than having these different locations. Like,
yeah,
the Geo2 forums is the most popular thing. We keep having to increase the amount of hardware for that. We have, if you're doing database replication and stuff, latency is a massive problem. You have to put this all in one location.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So at the moment, there's four machines at Hives NL, the Dutch social network.
Uh-huh.
They said, "Yeah, you guys can have four old machines."
Uh-huh.
No, sorry. Forums was at Hives, and now Bugzilla is on those old machines, and Forums has moved to Gossamer Threads in Vancouver. Because Forums didn't fit on the old machines anymore.
Right. So you had to ship a whole bunch of data.
That's why I said small things meaningless, because I didn't count in the forums. We have forums and... We have more forum subscribers than mailing list subscribers, but I think we have more active mailing list users than forum users. But
we do forums.debian.net, but not debian.org. So it's not official. That's the distinction between debian.net and debian.org. Debian.net, every Debian developer can set up a debian.net hostname. And debian.org is just, that's maybe something interesting. So if you have debian.org, that can only be modified by the Debian administration team.
I think last time I looked at the Gen 2 forums versus the mailing list, they were getting 5,000 forum posts a day, and the lists are only getting 3,000 or 4,000.
I think we're kind of the opposite. The lists get a lot of posts, and the forums are kind of dead.
That's not necessarily true. The problem was Jeroen and Tess had set that up, and then they really weren't into the forum thing, but they set it up because some people were, and then at some point they got compromised, and that wasn't very good, and then they disabled it, and then there came complaints, and then somebody else volunteered to maintain it, who was more into it.
I think we have more forum traffic than we have.
But I don't know how much forum, but the Debian mailing list is possibly huge.
Your mailing list is way busier than the Gen 2.
Yeah.
You have 12,000 Debian developers on there.
Yeah.
Plus the people who are interested.
Right. But we've got massive amounts of posts a day, and that's not even counting spam, of which 90% gets thrown away.
I know, I think we have 100, 200 mailing list posts a day on max days, so that's not that much.
I get that much in my mailing...
Yes.
I don't want to think about it.
So, here's another interesting statistic, again, about location. As of last Sunday, we were in 21 different countries. But on Monday, we lost a machine in Russia, which we don't know if we're going to get back again, so we're down to 20. But we are talking to people, two different data centers in China. So if that goes through the next week, we may be back up to 21 countries again.
Yeah, or another thing that's, we have a machine
in China. Is that a machine with a great firewall?
Actually, it is an issue because both of these data centers have multi-gigabit connectivity within China.
Right.
But one of them, and this is the truth, this guy actually only has 128 kilobyte link to the rest of the world.
How?
Because that is the maximum packet filtering cable that the government of China is willing to give him. He's got the capacity, but he can't push more than 128K at a time.
Because they throttle the traffic to that rate?
So the problem is he started syncing his main mirror in October last year. He hasn't finished yet.
How?
same thing in Africa.
Yeah.
He supposedly has only 10 Mbit link to Africa or into Egypt,
right.
That was. But we couldn't see the machine. It's just the initial rsync wasn't done after 4 days, after five days, just didn't finish. So if there's an open office update,
uh-huh.
He will be syncing for 3 or 5 days. He might have better connectivity into Egypt or into neighboring countries.
But it was out that it was blocked.
But you don't get the stuff there. So, okay, another question I would be interested in, who actually has infrastructure in South America? Besides Brazil, sorry.
No.
I think, I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Do we have Brazil? I think we have two Brazil machines, or one at least.
Let me check.
We
have one.
Or Africa?
We had one in Chile.
Africa?
We had one in Chile. We have had one in South Africa.
Post-case. Anyone else having machines in Africa?
We're looking it up.
Okay.
It's a moment.
So I know we don't.
/ machines.
Well,
not CDI.
And it's a slow machine.
Asia is another point. Well, yes, Taiwan probably, Singapore probably,
yeah, well,
South Korea.
I want stuff in Asia. I don't have anything in Asia.
It's hard to say because it only says the name of the sponsor rather than the location, so we'd have to check all the distance. It's going to take a while. Sorry.
4 minutes.
Okay.
We have to decide who wins.
Nobody.
We actually have a break afterwards, so we can run a little over if we want to.
Yeah.
But thanks. Yeah, we're supposed to finish it in 3 minutes.
A show of hands, who wins?
Yeah.
What was that?
who wins?
I win.
What do you win? You get to maintain
a
server?
that would be a great one.
The next talk starts in half an hour. So.
Murray in Colombia.
Yeah, we know. Murray in Colombia. Well, yeah, I think everybody has mirrors all over the world. That doesn't count.
Yeah.
So with the Chinese thing, just to finish that discussion, what we're working on is that Hong Kong has a lot of capacity. So what we're working on is a couple of USB hard drives. So we actually get it into Hong Kong and we ship using postal mail methods.
So
it might be funny, it actually sounds really funny, but what happens is, because we don't have any seats in China, and this is a machine that we run ourselves, there are, I think, 3 or 4 external mirrors who mirror us in China. We estimate that we've got 6 digits of users in China. When these guys want to hit traffic, when these guys want to hit update mirrors, in the other parts of the world, they generate a phenomenal amount of traffic out of China. And a lot of mirrors don't like it, whether it's because of politics, whether it's because of policy. We've had mirrors going away saying, you know, I set up a mirror for CentOS in Germany. I don't want, what, how much was it? You got 4 terabytes of transfer to China in 1 week?
That didn't quite come because he didn't have modlock IO on there, but they're getting hit from some download software. There's some download manager which hits the mirrors in parallel, and if you kill the IP address, just comes back with the next IP address. Just because those people can't get the software on different ways, so they try to spread as many mirrors as possible from as many IP addresses as possible. That seems to be some Chinese-based download management software. I've never heard of that before.
DDoS attack.
Do you guys have well-defined policies as to how often users should hit mirrors before they get banned?
We don't
control most mirrors. No.
Well, you guys the rsync mirrors. We don't.
Okay. With Gentoo, with the rsync mirror side, there's actually 2 separate tiers. The core set rsync.gentoo.org is strictly in-house. We guarantee the content on those mirrors. We validate that. And they typically run a few minutes ahead of the community mirrors, because not all community mirrors are well maintained and very fast.
Right.
All the actual core ones actually serve directly from RAM. Doesn't touch disk.
Wow.
How large are your data?
That rsync set, it's 280 bytes of data, but you have to watch out for inodes. If you don't watch out, 280 megabytes of data.
Okay.
I missed a unit.
Right. Yeah.
If you don't watch out for inodes, it loads up to about 700 megs.
Right.
Well, we at the moment have our internal sync machines open. If you know which machine it is, you can sync from there. But we reserve the right to publicize your machine there. Because the rsync panel says, well, only sync from here if you are an official mirror. It's not.
In Debian, I think it's all based on IP access lists. So. If you want to be a primary mirror, you talk to the mirror admins, and then they give you an account, and then
We have that for DVD at the moment. So if you want to surf the DVD, find another mirror who already has the DVD or ask.
Right, and then they work with SSH triggers. So once you finish, you SSH into there, and it starts the process, and you can disconnect again. So wonderful. It's a really wonderful model.
Yeah, we do have restricted mirrors for the community mirrors to access.
Right.
Like the rest of the Gentoo mirrors, the rsync.countrycode. Those are all the community-run ones that they have a specific mirror that only they can access and set against.
Sorry, does that mean that all of your rsync mirrors have to have a dedicated IP?
No.
Because if it's rsync.countrycode, you can't actually vhost rsync. Unless you just look for a path.
Yeah. We do have a bunch of them that they regularly send us the IP data, like every 60 minutes. If they haven't sent it, we expire it out the list. So kind of dynamic DNS,
right?
Mucked up.
Next slide.
Okay. I had some more slides, but we talked about that between slides. So that's the last one.
In last year, there is a wrapper called PowerBill that checks the mirrors you have from the mirror list and then download a piece of program from one mirror, another piece from another mirror, another piece from another mirror. So you don't download all the software and use all the bandwidth on a specific mirror. And it's based on ARIA too, probably. And it's really fast and
You should have been looking at the Mirror Brain talk just before this one.
Yeah, exactly. You should have been looking at
the
actual
link.
The talk right before this one was talking about a program, Mirror Brain, which actually does what you were just describing. So
I think we're talking for the same thing because ARIA 2 is a Metalink.
That was covered in the previous talk.
So yeah, whatever. there was a reason why I tried to block them together.
Yeah, that was a reason why I didn't want to do mirror in that talk here, because that's a whole kind of different problems, I guess.
Right, yeah, sure. I was going to say something.
You know, you're talking about bringing people in to the infrastructure teams. Does anybody do interviews? Or tasks, or do some sort of a selection based on... Something like that.
Definitely when new people join the infrastructure team, there's a couple of things off the top of the easy items to do on the to-do list. Here is something that needs doing.
I think if you start selecting people, I think you'll find out usually you've got too few volunteers as it is, and if you start selecting them, you end up with even less, and then you've got more age problems. It's usually best to give them some low-hanging fruit and see how they do. And then if they do well, then give them some more responsibilities. I think that's the best way to do it, because otherwise you just start rejecting people. And if they do the low-hanging fruit and either mess up or it takes way too long or something else goes wrong, then you know you don't want to give them anything else, and you move on and they move on. And they've had a chance and you've seen it didn't work out, so... I know I'm done at that point. I think that's the best way to do it, basically.
So what as an example, what would some of these tasks be?
One that comes up pretty frequently for Gentoo is actually the initial setup of a machine just prior to firing the automation. In our case with Gentoo, it's that you log into the machine, you're going to end up... We partition the machines manually. That's not part of the automation, just because the machines tend to vary a fair bit. So you have to be able to do that. You have to be able to partition the machine and set up the LVM. And then you have to read enough of our internal CF Engine documentation and setup to add the new machine to CF Engine. So that when you fire the automation, that the automation is going to work. And they get to read the logs and say, CF Engine failed to add this machine. Why? Because you forgot something in the configuration.
Not the last person to use CF Engine.
Yes. carry on using, because I'm not going to move to Puppet.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how good CF Engine is with role isolation, but Puppet and Chef and BCFG are really bad at it. So if you have to give somebody access to CF Engine and the manifest behind it, that person could pretty much do anything on any machine anywhere.
Yes, they. I know they can change a whole batch of stuff on almost any machine.
And then you boot them out, and you... Don't talk to him anymore.
In the entire time with the Gentoo infrastructure team, we've had a single person that went abusive, and he was dealt with within 6 hours.
Exactly, that's
okay,
what I'm talking about.
That's a question I have. How do you throw people out? Not that we have a luxury at the moment to be able to throw people out, but...
We've had that problem within Debian, and we've actually booted a few people out. Mostly for... not being abusive in infrastructure kind of things, but more socially abusive.
That happened in Mexico City some years ago, didn't it?
Yeah, that was one case. That was a very well-publicized case. And that was actually a bit like on the spot and figure out how to get help.
So I guess key distribution and class distribution is done automatically, so you can revoke
success
Well, we've got
an other directory, so you just remove them from the other directory. Your account is gone within a few hours, with a few minutes actually, because it contains a local cache of the other directory. So 15 minutes later, your account is gone. For uploads, there's a central GPG key server which contains your key. If it goes out of there, it syncs into the uploads maintenance software, and so a few minutes or
kicking out a regular developer is effective within a couple of minutes.
Right.
As the specific case was, we're having to boot somebody out of the infrastructure team.
Right.
The basic automation side of it is within half an hour, but all this stuff you have to go check by hand, since the person has had root access to the machines.
Right.
is 6 hours or so of work.
Right, right. Yeah, sure. That takes a bit more.
What do you do with people that are in the team, whether it's an infrastructure team, it doesn't matter, that have responsibilities, they worked well, but certainly during their life, they don't have a priority anymore to work on that. They just don't hear anymore from that. How do you process getting those people out of the project and get new people in? Because often they don't take responsibility by saying that they don't have the time anymore. They just disappear.
I'll give a quick answer to this one. But one of the other Gentoo guys that's probably in the room over was actually just going to be discussing it more fully. We have a mail that goes out twice a week. To a team, an internal team that we have called the retirement team, and you after 60 days with no commits, we'll send you an email and ask you what's up, and if you don't respond to us within another 60 days, you're gone.
You wait 60 days.
60 days to notification, and you get 60 days to respond.
So it's around 20 days.
120 days, 4 months.
Even if all your software is bug free.
Pardon?
If your software is bug free,
well, then you respond.
It's proof that you're going to respond
within Debian. It's slightly less automated. We've got a team which we don't call retirement, we call the MIA team, but it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
What we do there is if somebody's paid the bug pages is like many bugs there and nothing's happening or stuff like that, then you get a mail from the MIA team. What's up? A few more mails if nothing happens. It does go a lot faster than 60 days from that first moment, but there's a few reminders because maybe the mail didn't arrive or spam folders are going between, stuff like that.
We actually send a few more mails.
Yeah, sure, okay. Anyway.
It's 60 days and 60
right,
days.
Right, right. Anyway, so indeed, eventually, if we don't get any response or the mail bounces, which happens. People forgot to update their email address.
Well,
yeah,
we give people local email accounts. So
right, yeah.
We do check if you,
yes.
We do log in and see if you've
checked it. Debian.org mail is forwarded usually.
Yeah.
So if you don't update that and the mail bounces, then you're gone. But
if people are not active and
don't respond to the MIA team, then eventually they get thrown out.
Yeah, like particularly if they've been around for a long time and their mail starts bouncing, we will make an attempt to contact you via other means.
Yeah, so will the MIA team. They will try, but if you don't find them, then it's gone.
But this is in case that the people are off the internet or something like that. But what in the case that they're still around, they're still interested in helping, although they don't have the time, answering an email is easy. Staying in the team is easy. You know,
right.
It gives you respect to stay in the team, but they are not really.
What you mean is they're still active, semi-active on the team, but not as much as they should be.
They're active within the community, but not necessarily the team.
Yeah.
Right, something like that.
The team grows, but you can't go.
We separately encourage that. We encourage the teams to trim out their dead weight per se.
Yeah, I think
most of them do.
I don't think we have a process for that in Debian actually.
We don't.
And maybe we should. Because
the Perl team has probably 150 members,
somewhere like that,
but
well, some teams
most 30.
The infrastructure team, you don't want to have it too big.
Yeah.
Because the access
you don't want
to have it too small.
Yeah.
You want to have active numbers.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
I think the sort of thing is probably easy to quantify this code or this package, as you can see. It should be done eventually.
Yeah, I mean, like, within the infrastructure, so I can see that you're making commits to the infrastructure repository that controls things.
So should we sum up, maybe take one more question and finish up so people can get something to eat or something?
A question. From your experience, what will be the most important lessons for a new distribution startup?
That's a good question. Are we going to take 5 minutes for
that? I'd say think first and start. Because many distributions probably started by just one guy or two guys just started something, and then it grew and it grew and it grew, and in the end you end up with a pile of packages and a pile of infrastructure and some people, and nothing is organized, and you sit there and
document your processes.
Nothing is documented, nothing is organized, and then you think, now it doesn't work anymore, it's just stuck, it's just in some kind of a deadlock phase. So you just have to think, how do we do it, then do it, and let's just say, let's start by choosing a package format, let's start by choosing some basic package at the start, and then...
Basically what you're saying is you need a plan.
You need a plan, yes, you need a concrete plan, how do I organize my distribution? Because certainly we had that problem, there was a one guy show, he added more people and more people and more people, and suddenly the founder of the project and the main lead and the only one who had root access on every server suddenly went MIA, and the distribution was basically dead for, so there was a package in work, there were no new releases, was nothing really new for over a year, and still until he came there and said, well, I don't have time for anything, just someone else do it, and then we started, we need some processes, we need some things, and I think it was in 2005, after 4 years, or maybe 2006, after 5 years, and maybe that's a bit late.
Another thing: think of automation early, because it's easy to do system administration when you have 10 machines. As soon as we're 20 machines, you're completely lost.
And it's easy to set up automation when you have 10 machines, and it's much harder
to get that automation when the machines are already running, because they might look completely different from that what you're running at the moment.
They will look different from the one you get.
I want to be positive about that.
Well, no, the thing is, if you don't do automation in the beginning, then your machines will diverge. You will accumulate differences. And when you implement automation, when you will eventually implement automation, you need to work away those differences, and that makes it harder.
Even with automation, I guarantee you, there are things you're going to miss that are going to carry on diverging.
True, absolutely.
Sure, but it's easier to repair, because I repaired at a central point.
Yes.
I have repaired all the machines.
But you have to notice it.
So, and yes, documentation, in case nobody mentioned that, documentation is...
Yeah.
Well,
Did we say documentation?
Documenting processes.
Yes, indeed.
On that note, maybe we'll conclude the roundtable.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Thanks, guys.
50-minute break now?